Time again for poetry today on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. John Turner promotes and practices poetry. We'll find out how he does that on Scribble.
John, it's been a long time since I've heard you, but when I did first hear you years, I have no idea, you're all one blob in the back now, but it's been at least 20 or 30 years probably. You read down at Quad City Arts. I think you were doing poetry with Dale Hockey, among others.
Oh, yes.
Do you agree with Don Wooten that what he just said, that one does practice poetry?
Oh, constantly. There's poetry in everything. One of my favorite lessons was always doing what I called found poetry, finding poetry in books, in articles. One of the things I would do for my classes was simply take a phone book and find a poem in there.
Can you give us an example?
Well, if somebody had a phone book, yeah, I could do
that. we'll pretend.
Well, here's a poem right here. I wrote my Christmas letter this year, and I was talking about our anniversary. My wife and I celebrated our 45th wedding anniversary. And I wrote about it, and I realized, this sounds good. I can make a poem out of this. So I just took the Christmas letter and took the chunk out and wrote this: Sandra and John Turner, 45 years married. When we got married, many of our friends shook their heads. It'll end in tears. He's too weird. She's too shy. He's a bookworm who writes poetry. She puts all her passion into that painting stuff. He's not a team player. She'll never be happy just staying in the house. All of this was true. And here we are, almost half a century later. The friends who predicted our doom are filing their third set of divorce papers. Some have just given up, live in shacks surrounded by keep out signs and razor wire, sit on their porches, cross-eyed with rage, glowering at the horizon, waiting for some two-legged varmint to show up, cleaning and loading the AR-15s in anticipation. We prefer our lives to theirs.
Who gets these letters?
People with well-developed senses of humor.
I would hope so.
Well, why don't you take us back to the beginning? How did you fall into poetry?
When I was in seventh grade, I was taking a Spanish class with Mr. Martinez. And every week we would do a dialogue, 20 lines, simple stuff. Hola, Paco, ¿qué tal? ¿Cómo estás? And I quickly learned that he always started at the top of the alphabet, and by the time he got to Turner, I could have 18 lines memorized. So I never looked at the thing. Well, of course, you know what happened. One day he started at the bottom, and I blew it. I didn't know anything. So instead of just feeling bad or laughing it off, I wrote a poem about it and gave it to him. He was so impressed, he mimeographed it back in those days when we used mimeograph.
Oh, yeah.
And put it on the wall. And I thought, wow. This is cool. I like this. And I've kept at it since then. And then there was a book, which I believe I brought with me because I still use it, How Does a Poem Mean?
Oh, yeah.
By John Charity.
This
was
yeah.
given to me by my first creative writing teacher, Mr. Cox. And this book was like written in the mid-50s, and I think John Charity sat down and think, I am going to really mess up the brain of a kid in St. Louis in 1969. Which is exactly what he did. When I finished reading this book, I knew I was going to write poetry the rest of my life. I didn't know how I was going to make any money at it, and that's really not the point. The point is knowing what you're doing with your life, and I had that figured out, and that's what I've done.
That's going to say, it's true. If you want to write poetry, and that's what you want to do, you'll have to find a way to make a living in order to support that passion.
Mm-hmm.
It's there are books of poetry published, but they we've talked about this a lot, Tweet.
Well, they have it. Mary Oliver, for instance, one of the you know, great contemporary poets who just died last year. I think an average sale of her books of poetry nationwide is like 2,000.
Yeah, that's,
you know,
that is amazing. And yet there are more poets around than anyone imagines. There's so many people writing poetry.
Mm-hmm.
And do you work at encouraging that sort of thing?
Oh, absolutely. When I was teaching, and even when I'm not teaching, I point out to people, like Archibald MacLeish would say this, that poetry is a means to a certain kind of knowledge. It is a specialized language, like higher-level mathematics or musical notation. There's things you simply cannot know without knowing musical notation, just as there are things you cannot know without an appreciation of poetry.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you have some curiosity in this world and you'd like to know a world that you don't know exists, learn poetry.
When it comes to playing with a net or without a net, how do you go? Do you like structured forms like the sonnet and the quatrains and so on, or do you prefer free verse or blank verse? Or
I've done both. When I was younger, I did a lot of structured poetry, and then I started making up my own structures, rhyming the second and the seventh lines and stuff like that. And most of my poetry has fallen into blank verse and free verse, especially haiku. I've done a lot of haiku also, which I've had published.
Well, that's highly structured.
Yes.
Yeah, that's even more condensed than tweets.
Very much. Yeah.
And more useful, I think. But what did you have a blog or something? Were you using the internet to promote poetry?
Oh my. Here I'm beginning to show my age. Back in the 80s there was a thing called Poetry Slam, and it's still out there.
Mm-hmm.
There were slams held in Quad Cities run by Mr. Smith, the person who started the first ones. I won the first slams held in the Quad Cities, both of the first ones. I won the first one ever held at St. Ambrose. I won the first one held in Moline. And then I went online, and Simon & Schuster was running a slam room, and I won the first one they had. I then won the first one held by Warner Brothers. They had a slam room, and then I ran that room for 5 years. Mm-hmm. And each week we would have new poets come in and do their thing and compete. Interestingly enough, when you talk about how does this grow, I was undefeated for some time. And then somebody called Fairy Song showed up and just wiped me out. And I said, And so we had, I think, 15, 20 rematches. She beat me every time. And then to my great chagrin, I found out she was a 16-year-old runaway from North Carolina. Well, Erin Elizabeth Smith is now a full professor in creative writing and literature at the University of Mississippi, has started a magazine called Stirring, which I have been an assistant editor of for 20 years.
It's
one of the longest-running poetry magazines online. Helps other lost people find their way. She's just a terrific human being and a great poet.
Yeah. Were slams suitable to a specific age? It seems to me they became immensely popular. They almost took over the whole field of poetry.
They did.
Hasn't been a lot recently.
They kind of seem to have morphed into more rap battles, which is another kind of poetry, of course, somewhat more of a rhymed and lyric form of poetry, and not one that I do a lot. So I haven't been involved in those kind of slams. But yeah, it became an international phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. A friend of mine was over in Russia, and he met, Yevtushenko, a great poet.
Yes.
And he went to one of his readings. He said thousands of people were there.
Mm-hmm.
He said the Russians just eat up poetry. They love it.
Yes, but I believe that it has to be kind of approved before it's broadcast anyway. And
well, things have taken many interesting twists over in Russia.
Yeah, they not.
But here at home, poetry seems to continue, but kind of quietly.
Yes.
You don't hear much about it at all.
I don't seem to find as many slams or poetry readings going on in the Quad Cities as I used to, which is kind of sad. A lot of the people that I knew that were in it have moved on. Some have passed away, which is also sad. And, you know, my interests have diversified. I've become more interested in acting. I've had 14 of my plays produced in the Quad Cities. I've done 5 plays since I retired. And in fact, I'll be in the Prenzi production of The Two Noble Kinsmen, which will be in March and April of this year. Not quite sure what I'm doing yet because we're still casting, but that's something that's been taking up a lot of my time.
You mentioned Stirrings, and I ran across that when I was trying to find some information about you.
Right.
I didn't check police records, John, so you're okay.
Well, you honestly wouldn't have found anything, I'm happy to say.
But is Stirrings still stirring?
Oh, absolutely. As I say, we just celebrated our 20th year online and are going strong.
How does that work? Do you ask people to solicit poetry, or do you have contests, or what?
Mostly we solicit, and of course, once we got going and had been around, people started sending to Stirring, and then our main editor collects it all and then sends it out to everybody else. Except for Elizabeth, I have never met any other member of the staff in real space. Mm-hmm. We always commute by email or online. Especially me, email. I am the last person on Earth who is not on Facebook, sadly. And then we send our things in, and the main editor chooses, and we have a magazine.
You know, I subscribed last year to Poets and Writers just to see what it was like.
Hmm.
And I'm amazed at the number of poetry competitions there are.
Yeah.
There are far more competitions for poetry than there are for any other form of writing. And I think, is this a way that poetry can continue?
I think so. I am involved, now that you mention it, with a group called Poetry Out Loud, where they have high schoolers reading
right.
other people's poetry. And I'll be helping to judge that in Anawan later this month. And it's something I've been doing with Tracy White for many, many years. And there's some really good readers out there.
Uh-huh.
And that's great to see, that these people love poetry enough to learn the cadence and the feel and express it. And once you can do that, then you start doing it yourself.
It's not typical for a high school student to like poetry. You know, I'm amazed at the fact that there isn't a kid I know that doesn't like poetry at the age of 2, 3, and 4.
Yeah.
And by the time you get to junior high, people seem turned off by it or afraid of it or something. Why do you think that?
That's part of that.
Are we responsible as teachers?
Well, Roel, I'm sorry to tell you, but many of the teachers that I worked with don't like poetry. They don't understand it. They wish it wasn't in the book. And so when they come to teach it, it would be like me teaching brain surgery. You know,
okay.
It's necessary, but I don't know anything about it. Of course, little kids love words. They love the sound of words. A little kid loves hey, diddle, diddle, the
right.
cat and the fiddle. You don't have to stop and explain what a diddle is.
Right.
Yeah.
They like the sound of the word. But then as we get older, we learn no words can only have one meaning. And, you know, after that, it does. And that's not right. Words have many meanings. Words have many feelings. Which is why I do the found poetry assignment to separate sound from sense,
mm-hmm.
and help people get to feel both. And once you do that, then you learn to play with words again.
Well, you know, you couldn't do advertising if you didn't use some aspects of poetry. Metaphor, put a tiger in your tank is mm-hmm. a familiar one. We use some of the component parts of poetry all the time.
Sure.
And we are rather struck by those things, and we like them, but somehow it doesn't continue into a general appreciation of poetry. The two of you have taught. I have always been of the opinion that we should stop teaching Wordsworth, and, you know, some of the heavy ones, and go with people like my all-time favorite, Phyllis McGinley, or even Dorothy Parker. Poetry that is fun.
Mm-hmm.
And start there.
Yeah.
And then move up. Because once you start with poetry that is just a lark, then the rest of it comes a little easier. It's like growing up. We start with too heavy a dose of poetry, I think.
Well, that's why I would start with people like Richard Brautigan, whose poetry was...
Haven't heard his name for years.
Yeah, but I loved his work.
Oh, yeah.
You know, or Russell Edson, whose work is kind of out there. And if I may say so, my own work is kind of quirky in that respect. Well, I like to mix
some
images.
Give us a quirky poem, John.
Well, this is based on a line that was in a student paper. You know, as you know, we grade a lot of papers.
We do.
And so this poem is called The Bawd of Amherst. The student journal said, Emily Dickinson was sort of an old-time Marilyn Monroe. Well, now, because I could not stop for death, I did a bump and grind, comes to mind, as the blonde bombshell of Boston trips her trochaic way into the literary anthologies. Or, I heard a fly buzz when I died, as air swirled up my dress. Or, picture Emily Dickinson nude on a calendar behind the anvil in blacksmith's shop. Or, here's Emily Dickinson in a wraparound sheer dress, all décolletage, singing a breathy happy birthday to Abraham Lincoln at the second inaugural ball, Walt Whitman happily beating time in the background. Or, imagine an idolized movie star working out her unhappiness on 1,700 hidden scraps of paper, and then going on with life, while in a Victorian mansion, a straight-haired woman pours a dram from the decanter, swallows a handful of red, white, and blue pills, and slowly trods on to her bedroom, thinking all the time of narrow houses in the grass.
Now, you've got to be fairly educated to get what there is to be gotten in that poem.
Oh, you have to know Emily Dickinson and Marilyn Monroe.
Right.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, poetry does require a little bit of booting up. You know, to understand a poem, I always told my students you had to understand the literal meaning, the symbolic meaning. If lucky, you get to learn the personal meaning from the poet, but especially you have to know the historical context. Where did this poem come from? What is it referring to? You know, you can't separate Bob Dylan's poems from the era of Vietnam mm-hmm. without losing a lot. And so, it involves some input from the
using that poem, let me try out a Jane Hirschfield comment about you. She's currently one of my favorite existing poets. Mm. She has a book on nine windows, I think, ways into poetry.
Mm.
Here's her statement. No good poem is ever entirely safe.
Oh, certainly not. Sure.
Why not?
Well, because life isn't entirely safe. Because the important things in life are disturbing. You know, okay. Love, death, hate, anger, joy, fury. We have to deal with these emotions. The further away we get from the dance, as Edgar Allan, as Ezra Pound said, the weaker the poem. And, you know, dance is energy, is movement. So, you have to have these things.
I look at that from another angle, in the same way, I've always said a poem is like a hand grenade. And when it explodes in meaning, you're really not sure who's going to be hit and how.
Sure.
And so in that sense, a poem is not safe, because when you write it, you may have intended one thing, and when you read it, you may find another.
Sure.
I can remember reading the humorous essays of S.J. Perlman when I was in mm-hmm. college. And I thought, boy, this is a real hoot. This guy is funny. I went back to it 30 years later, and it was much funnier because I had learned a lot more and was able to pick up more in his essay than I could the first time.
Oh, absolutely. Sure.
I think that happens in poetry, too.
Yeah, we read different books as we get older. You know, Catcher in the Rye was a way different book when I started teaching it than it was when I first read it when I was 12.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's, and poetry does that, because you're never really sure. When you write a poem, I don't think you're entirely in control of what you're doing.
No.
Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. Most of my writing has not exactly written itself, but I get started and then it goes where it wants to go. And I think most writing, whether it be music or poetry, is like that. You write it and then you impose structure on it afterwards. You know, I think Mozart sat down and said, okay, I'm going to put a half note here and a semiquaver there and a quarter rest. No, he had the melody and then he said, oh, it's a sonata, or oh, it's an adagio. You know, and I think the same thing happens with poems, sure.
Do you think one of the big debates that I grew up with is, if you want to be a creative writer, poet, or, you know, novelist or whatever, you shouldn't do something that requires creativity like teaching. You ought to be gas station attendant so your whole energies can be devoted to writing.
Well,
does teaching get in your way or does it aid you?
Well, let's put it this way. I have been a gas station attendant and I've also worked in nursing homes and things like that. And when you come home from a day's work, poetry is the last thing on your mind. You want to forget where you've been and go to sleep. Teaching can drain you, of course. But every now and then you get a line like this from a student and boom, off you go. Or like Tolkien's story. You know, he was grading papers. He turned a paper over and said, in a hole under a hill, there lived a hobbit. Boom, and everything else grows from
right.
But, you know, I agree. I think teaching, I've done many things in my life, but never anything as hard as teaching.
Mm-hmm.
This is teaching in high school, senior English. And it talk about draining. Boy, that did it. To try to keep 20-some students on the path to understanding and so on. I'd come out of that school on my knees because mm-hmm. I've never had anything really drain me like that. And I've done a lot of things. Directing a play is tough. Doing live television programs is really tough. But teaching high school, that's not for sissies.
No.
But it does, it drains you, and maybe you can't go on from that. What do you think?
Well, I know. I think it adds. I mean, I think it gets the juices going.
Uh-huh.
I agree about being a gas station attendant. You come home from that. Well, I did. I put, you know, labels on 5-gallon paint cans for the summer. I was going to write. Well, I came home and just zonked out.
Yeah.
But you remember when we had these, Genesee School had these classes for teachers on teaching the classics and so on. And the day we asked the teachers to tell us about their days, you and I just looked at one another and thought, man, I could not do that. Mm-hmm. You couldn't do it. It's gotten much more difficult than it was when I was teaching.
Right.
And you have had an easy time of it teaching in college.
I've had a very easy time of it, comparatively.
Well, I would always set myself a goal in my creative writing classes. I would always write with them. You know, if I had an assignment for them, I would do one too. And that always got me off. And I got that into that habit from my creative writing teacher in college, which was Nancy Price, you know, who wrote Sleeping with the Enemy and so many other good books.
Mm-hmm. Give us another poem.
Okay. A lot of my poems role here in his work deals with things outside, like in Rock Island Lines. Many of my poems deal with the Quad Cities, but inside, not just inside me or, let's see. I was going to do one that was kind of angry, but I don't feel kind of angry right now. I'm going to do one about...
I could throw something at you.
I've done a whole series of poems on mythical Iowa animals, and this one is the dragonfly. A student was once saying that they didn't have butterflies in their stomach, they had dragonflies. And I thought, all right. So, morning. Chrysalis turns to ash. Contents fall, gathering grace. Mailed and silvered, golden wings, tiny bronze claws, settling haunches, alight in a dandelion dust. The dragonfly. 2. From the Handbook. The dragonfly caterpillar is one of those wonders of summer that makes life in the high valleys of the mythical Iowa mountains the joy that it is. The bright scarlet caterpillar with diamond backs and platinum bands eats only garden pests and is a welcome backyard visitor. It has no natural enemies except for the occasional misguided sparrow or mouse whose blowtorched remains stand as simmering warnings to give this little critter an extra wide berth. See page 165 for handy tips on treating those unsightly scorched grass divots. Part 3. Night. It's another hot, sweltering evening up here in the Iowa mountains. How it gets moist and tropical at 9,000 feet. That's Iowa for you. Now the fun begins. Get yourself an iced glass of lemonade. Sit back in the lounge and watch the first of the night's flying commando squids take on the last of the day's dragonflies. They're pretty evenly matched. Nobody really gets hurt. But man, those bursts of dragonfly flame. It drives the chromatospores on the squids absolutely crazy, flashing gold and yellow and green and purple and orange. It's just the 4th of July every night up here in the Iowa mountains.
This is all good stuff, John.
Gee. Yeah, it really is. We have a couple minutes left. Give us another poem. I'm having fun.
Okay. How about one? Like so many other poets, I write a lot about quantum mechanics. And this one's called Schrödinger's Coffee. You may know the story of Schrödinger's cat.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, it's kind of explained in the poem. Pulled into the parking lot, and I thought, did I bring my coffee or didn't I? It ought to be in the back seat, but I can't see it from here. Ah. I thought, Schrödinger's cat all over again. You know, Schrödinger's imaginary experiment of having a cat in a box with a poison pill set to go off if a photon hits it. You don't know if it went off until you open the box. Until then, the cat remains merely a wave function, Schrödinger says, and doesn't collapse into either alive or dead reality until you open the box. So, as long as I'm thinking about my coffee without looking, it may, or may not, be here in a car with me. So I think about it harder and harder, using every neuron in my early morning head to virtually will actual coffee into this waveform existent. I will it, and whoosh! The car is filled with hot liquid. I'm staring at the world through a steaming brown patina. Java flows out of my open window into the parking lot. Wow. Next time I think I better think of the thermos bottle, too.
Well, John, I must say, your poetry is extraordinarily entertaining. You still work for Stirrings Magazine?
Yes, I do.
And you find that on the internet?
Mm-hmm.
How do you do that?
Stirring.org. Just go there.
Stirring what?
Dot org.
Stirring.org.
Yeah.
And do people contribute to it over the internet?
Is certainly. That the way?
You don't bother with the mail service.
Not to my knowledge.
Well, I must say, it's interesting. And if you ever get into the poetry slam business, let us know.
I will.
Because I want to see Roll Tweet slam a few poems. I'm waiting for that event. But in the meantime, thank you very much, John. We appreciate having you here.
Thank you for having me.
And with that, we will summon the theme and make our way out. I'm Don Wooten with Roll Tweet, and we invite you to join us again next week when we'll come back for another half hour of conversation about people who write stuff and people who read it on Scribble.